not bad for Sunday morning after some of the unspeakable things that I understand went on last night. I am an alcoholic and a drug addict, and my name is Mildred. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Not bad for Sunday morning. I wonder what I did. I wonder what I did to deserve being here this weekend. I'm not through with you yet. I expected to be met at the airport by one person, not knowing that there were five other nuts waiting there. Four from your area and two from California. And just lest you do not know who the four were, their names are Stan and Dan and Marianne and Sally. We went to the restaurant, and after someone falling out of the van and somebody falling into the restaurant, we got to our table. And at some point, the conversation turned to some poor person who at one time or other was seen to be wearing sunglasses at night. The conversation flowed fast and furious. Believe me, about the reasons why anybody would wear sunglasses at night. Somebody said, I wonder what they could possibly be hiding behind those glasses. I couldn't believe I was listening to this, because there I had my sunglasses perched beside my plate. So at some moment when I thought it was dramatically appropriate, I took them up and put them on and said, but I wear these at night. At which point, somebody suggested that maybe I was not fit to be the spiritual speaker. And the cowards in the group said, oh, well, yours aren't that dark. We can still see your eyes. I won't tell you who has a yellow streak down his or her back. Let them reveal it themselves. Here, Dan, open up. I said Dan Grapes in the restaurant. I should have known this was going to be a crazy weekend. Last Sunday, I had a conversation with Kurt in the afternoon, who was telling me about his problems with the celibate life. And that maybe this would be the weekend. Not him, the other one. He's ran away, he's not here. I hope your life isn't celibate. Perhaps you should join Dick if it is. I felt so sorry for Kurt, I almost offered myself. But then I wasn't sure whether he likes older women. I thought we'll just let events take their course as the weekend progresses. I really do thank you for inviting me. It has really been an absolutely wonderful weekend. I was just saying to Sally, I don't know when I have been so sleepy, but I think I'm so sleepy because I've laughed so much. And I thank you for your kindness and your wonderful hospitality. You know, I go into many places and not everybody is as warm and as friendly. I'm sure they're as loving and as caring, but not all people express it as openly. I think it's absolutely marvelous. And, you know, I will not forget this weekend. I guess after all the speakers that you have heard this week, and I really have to be a bit of a fool or a member of AA to get up here and follow that line. Thinking last night, how do you get up here and say anything that hasn't really already been said? How do you say it in a witty manner? How do you say it in an interesting manner? Well, I don't know if I can do that, but I guess I do have a footprint to leave on the sands of time. I don't know how large that footprint is. I don't know whether it's larger than that of others or whether it's smaller than that of others. It doesn't really matter. The fact is that I do have a footprint to leave here. So I will share with you, to the best of my ability, my experience and how I feel about the spiritual life, because I think that is really the focus of what I'm to be talking about this morning. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not of my own will. I guess I came with the same reason that this fellow acted that I'm going to tell you about. It seems that he was very drunk one night and walked home through a graveyard, and he fell into a newly dug grave. And he tried to claw his way out, but he kept sliding back into the grave, so finally he just gave it up, and he slid back, and he sat down in the corner, and he was down there. Finally, he kind of fell asleep, muttering to himself, when a second fellow came through the graveyard, and he too fell in. And he tried what the first fellow had tried. He tried to claw his way out, and, you know, he'd climb up, and he'd slide back, and he'd climb up, and he'd slide back, at which point number one in the grave sort of woke up, and he saw what was going on, and he got up, and he tapped number two on the shoulder, and he said, "You're not going to get out of here." He did. I'm glad to be alive. I'm grateful to be an alcoholic, and I'm proud to be a member of this fellowship. And if you are new, you may think that that qualifies me for the funny farm. I assure you, I am no stranger to funny farms. Having been incarcerated in one or the other at least 29 times that I can count, for periods ranging from 5 days to 5 months, either by my own will or by the will of others, while I was there, they tried, I guess, every known therapy that had been devised at that time. At one time, I even had 25 electroshock treatments. That gives you quite a buzz, believe me. They diagnosed me. I have a file sitting somewhere that thick. And one time I was diagnosed as being a schizophrenic. And then they said I was a schizophrenic paranoid and a paranoid schizophrenic, and that I had a schizoid personality and a paranoid personality, and that I was manic depressive depressed and manic depressive manic. So by the time somebody came along and suggested that I was alcoholic, that was very good news indeed. I was born on a farm in Saskatchewan, a girl, obviously, the youngest of 10 children, a Roman Catholic and German. And since it's become fashionable to betray one's age, I'll tell you that I was born in 1932, which makes me 55 now, so you don't have to count on your fingers and toes. So if you do a little calculating, you can know that by the time I was going to school and relating to other people, it was really not fashionable to be German. And I was ashamed of that fact. I don't really know why. I have lots of theories about it, and the theories really don't matter. You've heard lots about get into action if you want to get well. But I can tell you the fact. I never liked being alive. I, as a child, felt alone. I never felt a part of my family. I never felt a part of my parents. I never felt a part of my school chums. I just never felt I belonged. When I was 12, my parents sent me to high school at a convent boarding school. I didn't fit there either. I never fit anywhere until I came to this program in 1973. And I believe that has really been the highlight of my life. Anyway, this loneliness and this feeling of being an oddball and this feeling that I was different cast a real spell over me. It was like a feeling of gloom. My brothers and sisters used to say to me, "You're so lucky. You're so pretty and you're so talented. And, you know, you don't have to work like we did on the farm. You can go to school and get an education and all this kind of stuff." Now, I couldn't tell anybody what was going on inside me. It didn't seem that I had the ability to communicate with them, and finally I gave it up. And I thought, nobody understands me, and I sort of lived in my own little world. At 18, I decided to go to a convent, which may not be the smartest move for a girl to make who doesn't like other women. For somebody who doesn't like to be regimented, for somebody who hasn't really got a whole lot of living skills. But, you know, you can ask me and I can, again, give you theories about why I went to a convent. I think it was partly running away from my womanhood. I didn't want to get married and have babies and be like my sisters and my mother. I also think, I believe sort of, that if I did the hardest thing I could think of, and I couldn't think of anything worse than going to a convent, that maybe God would fix me. All my life I've been looking for somebody who would fix me. And so I went there. I was drunk the day I entered, and I stayed drunk for most of the 15 years that I was there. Fortunately, I was capable. I was an organist. I was a musician. I always had lots of choirs, and I was organist in the churches. I trained the servers, and so I had lots of opportunity to be in the churches. I used to have my booze delivered to the bell tower of the church, and while all else failed, I drank mass wine. Father used to say, "Gee, we said we use a lot of mass wine since you're here." And I used to finger the best server in the group, because I knew Father wouldn't believe it anyway, but it sounded as good as any. I'd say, "You know, I've seen him around the church a lot. Do you think he might be taking some of this?" Anyway, after this 15 years, Mother Superior called me, and my father had died, and I went home, and I was drunk the whole time. And in those days, we wore the long black garb. There was nothing inconspicuous about us, believe me. And I certainly was not inconspicuous at that first funeral, being the only nun there and the youngest of the family. And when I got back to Ontario, Mother Superior called me in and said, "Would you like to leave?" Well, of course I wanted to leave. I never wanted to be there. But I had been told that if the church allows you to take final vows, God has given you a vocation, and if you don't keep that vocation, then you may lose your immortal soul. And since I believed in the heaven, the hell, and the purgatory, and that was the end of life, I didn't know how it all fit in, but I thought I better stay there. So when this authority figure came to me and said, "You want to leave?" I said, "What do you think?" And she said, and then I found out they had been watching me. The drunken nun was the best kept secret in the convent, or maybe the most open secret that nobody talked about, because I was an enigma. I worked hard. I did operettas, and I had 300 voice choral clubs, and I taught, and I went to university, and I trained the servers, and I had choirs and choral clubs. I was really just a whirling dervish. And alcoholics shouldn't act that way. And, you know, Mother Superior, and I recall her saying this to me. She said, "You know, you're not happy here, are you?" Well, I guess that was the understatement of the year. And she said, "You know, if you're young enough to make a life for yourself..." This is 1966, and I was 33 years of age. And she said, "You're young enough..." And she said, "I think if you're willing, we'll write to Rome." And I wrote to Rome, and she wrote to Rome, and I got my dispensation. I stood on the convent steps January the 10th, 1966. You know, how could I have lived for 33 years and not know the basics of living? I knew absolutely nothing, because I was so immature that I really believed my problems were over. I thought it was as simple as taking off the habit, getting back my secular name, being dispensed from keeping the holy rule and vows, and I was just going to sail out there, and somebody was going to find me, and I was going to be okay. Not so. I descended into what I can simply call a maelstrom. If there is a hell, I've had it, just like many of you have had yours. I went to the only place where I could find people who dealt with me on the level that I wanted to deal, which was namely the level of alcohol. "Don't underestimate the power of alcohol," I think it was Cliff who said last night. A few drinks of that can accomplish what no psychiatrist can ever accomplish. And so I went to the bars, and I became a tramp. I'm ashamed of it in one sense, but it's the truth. I became a tramp, and then began my trips to the church, to the confession, to say, you know, go to confession and say, "Father, I'm sorry, you know, what's happening to me." The conclusion I came to was that I was bad, because bad people left the convent, and see, I was reaping the reward, and this is why I was behaving the way I was, and I was extremely confused, and, you know, it was a bad, bad scene that 10 months. I finally had myself signed into an insane asylum, as it was called then, and I did that because I had wet somebody's bed. It seems fashionable this weekend also to talk about our bladder problem. Everybody's had a go at that. I'm staying with a girlfriend, and I had wet the bed, and her husband said, "Look, she's going to ruin every mattress in this house. Get her out of here." And I had no home to go to, so I went to the mental institution, and they took me in. And my brother found me there, and he took me back to Saskatoon in Saskatchewan.
to the university hospital there, to the psychiatric center, and there I met the man who was to become my husband, the psychiatrist, wouldn't you know? I doubt that either one of us was too tightly wrapped, because while I was still a patient, he invited me out, and I accepted. And so began a very interesting relationship. As Pat said yesterday, the rocks in his head fit the holes in hers, and I think that sort of fit our relationship, too. We really had complementary neuroses. I think if you consider the fact a drunken ex-nun and a drunken psychiatrist, you can see the limitless possibilities. However, I did go to Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of this. I have a brother who's been sober now by, I guess, about 35 years. And I remember when he was the town drunk, considered the village idiot and the black sheep of the family, and I also had received word that he had gone to this organization in the early 50s, and he was now, you know, changed. He'd gone to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was now, you know, so different, they said. He was interested in the grass and the trees, and he was doing what he ought to be doing, and he was helping people, and so on and so on and so on. So when this psychiatrist said, Alcoholics Anonymous, that was no big deal to me. I went for 3 weeks. It was wonderful. And then the reason for which I drank and took drugs reasserted itself. I could not manage my emotions. And so, rather than getting into the program, I believe that God's timing is never wrong. And I believe you don't hear until you hear. I was in Prince Albert at the time with some of the stalwarts in this program, and I didn't hear what they said. I sat in these seats, and I will say this to the everlasting credit of Alcoholics Anonymous and the members in it. I sat there for 5.5 years with my eyes bugging out of my head, and nobody ever said, you shouldn't come here. They occasionally asked me, can we help you? Cease used to say to me, me? They let me go to the hospital. I'm not sure. To the jail. I went to the women's jail for 2 years, and I'm not sure whether I carried the disease or the message. I think I carried the disease. But anyway, I was busy doing the best I could. But eventually, I stayed away from meetings, and eventually, I started thinking different. I started thinking, rather than us alcoholics, I thought you alcoholics, and it wasn't long until I was drinking. And, of course, by this time I was married, the situations were just more bizarre. You don't want to hear all that stuff. You know how to throw up and sweat and shake and do all that kind of stuff. You can ask me, was I a periodic drinker or a daily drinker? No, I was an anytime there's alcohol around drinker. I wanted to blot out how I felt. I hated the way I felt. I hated who I was. I hated the fact that I had been born. I could see no conceivable reason for me being on the face of the earth. And I could see really no way out. So it was simply a question of stay as drunk as you can for as long as you can, or screw up your mind with drugs. Do it whatever way. I didn't want to face reality. You know, I have no quarrel with the preamble. In there it says, half measures avail us nothing. Giving up the alcohol and not the drugs, that's a half measure, and it availed me nothing. I had to be ready to give up my old ideas that I could do it my way. You know, and I have learned that knowing I have a problem will not keep me sober. Knowing why, I don't know why I have an alcoholic body or whatever, that's not going to do it either if I did know. Fear isn't going to do it for me. I've had DTs, and I've had convulsions, and I've woken up out of blackouts that were just absolutely horrendous when I found out where I'd been and what I'd been doing and saying. Because, you know, in that period, I began drinking with bank presidents and industrial giants, but then, of course, they probably never thought they were drinking with an ex-nun either. But fear isn't going to do it, and certainly self-will or willpower. I've got a lot of willpower, but I can tell you, I'm in this room this morning not because of you. I'm in this room because of me. My willpower will not keep me sober. My willpower, I think, is useful to me to keep me on the path that I should be following and doing the things that I should be doing so that I can stay sober and live comfortably in this world. I woke up in a psychiatric ward, which will really not surprise you, on May the 18th, 1973, and had a spiritual experience. Or a moment of clarity, I don't care what you call it. I know that I woke up that morning, and I was the old person that I had always been for 40 years, and when I left the room that morning, I was changed. Because I had, for the first time in my life, realized Yes, I do drink too much, and I do take too many drugs, and that has to go if I have got a hope for a happy life. And I made a decision that morning, and I surrendered to that fact. You know what the straw was that broke the camel's back? I think for each of us, there's a point beyond which we won't go. And for me, that point was, as I sat there that morning, it suddenly came home to me, we're bankrupt. And indeed, we were. It wasn't but a few days, and the sheriff nailed the door shut, sold our property, sold our goods, so that by the time I did get to a hospital, to a treatment center, I had all my belongings in two suitcases. But you know what happened that morning? I think really that often when things are getting worse, they have to get worse before they can get better. It's like a boil. You can't take the pus out of a boil before it's right. And I think that's the way it was with my life. It had to get to that point. And as I look at situations in my life, often they have to get worse before I come to a point of surrender where I really do let it go and let God. I've done everything I can, and then it's okay. And that's what happened that morning. I lost the compulsion to drink, and I have never had it back since. And I did not go into a nice situation. I left that hospital that afternoon, back into a house where my husband was still drinking, and there was more booze around than I had ever seen when I'd wanted it before. I could never find it. Here it was all out in the open. And one day, my husband even handed me a drink of orange juice. I remembered to smell it, and it was laced with vodka. I guess he knew that if I ever got sober, the sick games that we played were going to be over. Because if I got better, if I stopped drinking, something was going to happen. Well, I went to a treatment place called Dawnwood, which is Dr. Bell's center in Toronto. He's got a very well-known name. I'm glad that I went. I wouldn't ever knock that experience. And it was good for me. I got a little bit of self-respect back, and I met a few people. I was taken out of that hell hole of alcoholism that we had been living in. And I left the hospital at the end of July. No home to go to. A friend took me in and for a few days. And then the hospital got some welfare money, and I got a place down on Skid Row. And we were poor that first year. And I mention that because it was important to me. That, for me, was an ego deflation in depth. I had lost all visible means of manipulating other people. Understand what I'm saying. I was a nobody and a nothing. Nobody in Toronto cared that this person was walking down the street. And I didn't have the means. I didn't have anything about me. My self-confidence was totally shattered, so that I found out who I was. And I can tell you that my first year of sobriety, my husband also went into the treatment center eventually, and that we were poor. We were so poor that sometimes we didn't have enough to eat. And I'm grateful for that experience, because I found out what is important in life. And I know today that if I had to, I could eat bread and water, and I know I could wash dishes for a living, and I could do it without grumbling, because the success is not in the job. The success is in me. The attitude is not in what I do. The attitude is in what I bring to that job. And the good attitude is in me today, and that's what I've learned here. Because of the poverty, we had two dogs put to sleep. And that still jerks my heart when I talk about it. I still can't look objectively at Boston Bull Terriers, because I see Timmy and Tammy in those. Little Tammy, she would sit on the shoulder. She was about as big as what I'm showing you here. And Timmy, he was a little bigger than she was. And the two of them, they'd look at you, and I swear to God, they could almost talk. And yet we didn't have the wherewithal to keep them. And I loved those animals, so you may say, well, that's a funny way of showing it, by having them put to sleep. But my thinking was this way. We had babied them and pampered them, and when we got drunk, we put them into the kennels, and then we'd take them out. I just felt, God, we've cried enough. They've cried enough. Better to have them put to rest. So I took them. They were at a kennel at the time, and I finally convinced my husband that this is what should be done. He said, I can't do it. So the lady at the place said, if you bring me the letter authorizing this, she said, I will have them put down for you. And I went into that place that day, and I heard them. I have a sense, I still have a sense, that they knew that I was there, that they sensed that I was there. And I heard them whining downstairs. And with all my heart, I wanted to go downstairs and pick those animals up and cuddle them, because they were the only thing left in this world that really loved me and that I really loved. And I knew that if I did that, I was not going to get well. There was something said to me, go on, you made a decision, carry it out. I think that is the first rational action that I ever took in my life, and I think it strengthened my backbone. Because for the first time in my life, I did what I knew at that time, the way I thought, was the thing I ought to do no matter how it hurts, rather than live by my feelings. And I'm going to talk a lot about my feelings. Because they were the reason I drank. I couldn't deal with them. I couldn't deal with my feelings toward other people, and I sure didn't like my feelings toward myself and toward God. I met a person at the institution at Donwood who became important to me because he set me back on my heels. For 40 years, I had spent endless hours going to psychiatrists, doctors, Jesuits, nurses, whoever would listen to me, telling them why I was the way I was. You know, I don't know if anybody ever set me back on my heels, but I'll tell you Dr. Maharaj did, because when I was out of the institution about three weeks, something occurred and I had sort of been planning to kill myself. I went back to the institution the next day to tell him this. And he sat me down and he said, Mildred, I have just one thing to say to you. He said, if you want to commit suicide, that's what you have to do. That's not a very nice thing to say to me. He said, if you want, you know, he said, and if you do, I remember this distinctly. He said, and if you do, he said, don't go out blaming the church and the convent and your parents and all that crap that you talk about. Recognize that you can get well if you want to, if you're willing to pay the price, but you're going to have to do some things. But he said, it is your choice. And that was the end of the interview. By the time I got out to the bus, I knew that somebody had read my mail. He knew me. And I, you know, that is the kindest, one of the kindest things that anybody has ever done to me. Because he just jerked me up short and said, hey, this isn't the way it's going to be. And I understood very clearly what he had said to me in those few sentences. And so, eventually, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was about 6 months. It wasn't bad. I used to go to the institution. They used to have follow-up meetings. But you know what was missing? What was missing was the program that we have here. Because really, nowhere. We had group therapy, but I think group therapy can really be a self-indulgence sometimes. The doing the 12 steps cannot be a self-indulgence. If I do the 12 steps, I am going to see the causes and conditions that brought me to the situation. I am going to understand that the problem and the enemy is not out there. The problem and the enemy is inside myself, and I have the opportunity then to do something about it. And so I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous simply because I had nowhere else to go. And there were friendly faces, and I got hooked. Because I do believe when you and I, at a meeting, look into each other's eyes and try to help each other, it is not just you and I, but there is a presence there. And I think that is the magic, and that is the miracle, and that is what goes on here. The presence of love, the presence of power of the Spirit is with us, and that's what keeps us together, because the Looney Tune organization sure doesn't. My vice principal asked me a couple of weeks ago when I came back from a conference. He said, who's the president of AA? Where's the president? And he was asking me all these questions, and finally he laughed, and I laughed too, because it sounded so stupid. How do we stay together? How does this whole organization work? It doesn't make any sense. If you believe that we are the organization, if you understand that we're held together by the Spirit, then it all makes sense. I got into the steps. I've had three sponsors. The first lady that sponsored me, she was good for me at the time. She gave me what she could, and she gave me what I needed. She had told me that I didn't have to wait for my husband to get well. Now, that may not seem very revealing to you, but it sure was to me, because I was sitting there thinking, well, if I could get him moving. You know, we were quite a pair. There we sat, the two of us. One time we counted up. Between the two of us, we had 7 degrees. He had 4 and I had 3, and I do know where they put thermometers, Cliff. Between us, we had 44 years of formal schooling, and there he's sitting saying, I can't go out looking for a job. I'm too depressed, and I'm making $2.20 an hour. Sure doesn't say much for book learning, does it? I got into this. So after about 2 months, I guess sober about 8 months at this time, I changed sponsors because I knew that I needed to get into the steps, and she wasn't strong enough to take me through the steps, and I knew there was a man who was about as pig-headed and bull-headed as I am, and I knew that he could do the job. And so he said, yes, I will be your sponsor as long as we understand one thing. He wasn't very sensitive either. He said, as long as you agree that if you're upset, you're wrong. And we start from that. I thought I really had not chosen well. But as it turned out, I had chosen very well. God's timing is never wrong. He has always sent to me exactly who and what I have needed. And this man helped me go through the steps, and he helped me deal with some groundwork in dealing with my emotions. You know, it's fine to leave here today and say, well, I'm going to go home and I'm going to control my emotions. Guess what? I used to leave meetings and I'd say, I'm going to leave this meeting and I'm not going to be angry tomorrow. Guess what? Somebody got it the next day worse than ever. If I'm going to change, I've got to have some strategies. And he was just fantastic in this, helping me, telling me little things, showing me little things that I could do. But I had to do it. But he showed me what it was that I had to do. I believe basically that the steps are really very simple. And if you're new, I'm not here to give advice, but I believe in those steps. Because I did the first 9 steps and they did exactly what they promised. They cleared away the wreckage of the past. I know that the past is with me as a living reality of what I am, but I don't worry about the past. It's done. It's finished. It's gone. In that sense. And that's what the steps did, because in 1, I was able to admit that I had a problem. In 2, like a reasonable person, if I've got a problem and can't deal with it myself, I go ask for help. And in 3, I made a decision. Oh, God, did I get screwed up on 3? Because I wanted to get into all the theology and philosophy I knew. And my sponsor said to me just exactly what Doug's sponsor said to him. Get on with this thing. You're missing the important words. And what I was missing was made a decision. To do what? To get on with the rest of the steps. That, to me, is the way you turn your will and your life over to the care of God. And so I did 4, and I did 5 with a priest because of my background. I felt that I should do that. 6 and 7 tell me how God works in this world. It always amazes me. You know, everything else is a big la-di-da chapter and lots of paragraphs to explain it. When we get to 6 and 7, there are 2 paragraphs in the big book. Why? Because I think everything revolves around how God works in this world. I think God works for me, through me. If I can do it for myself, he expects me to do it for myself. I always wanted somebody to do it to me, fix me, send down the magic dust so I can be okay, and it never worked. I remember sitting at discussion meetings, and I used to say, I wonder when God is going to remove my defects of character. I think I'm ready. And I will launder the language. But my sponsor took me aside one day, and he said, I cannot stand to hear that one more time. He said, you dummy, don't you realize he'll take them away when you stop doing them? And then in 8 and 9, I made my peace with others so I could hold my head high. And I'll talk a little more about that. And then I'm at the end of 9. And up to that time, I used to think to myself, well, when I get 2 done, I'll feel better. When I get 3 done. When I get 4 done. When I get 5 done. Here, I had done all the cleanup steps. And I had done a thorough job of them. Even my mean sponsor agreed I had done a good job. And I didn't feel right. By this time, I was teaching, and I should tell you about this before I go on. When I was a year sober, I was fortunate enough to get back into the teaching profession. I, who am an English major, found a job as a dealing with adolescents with learning difficulties. I didn't know anything about this. Anyway, I went back to this friend, Dr. Maharaj, and I told him I was feeling incompetent. And he said, that's probably because you are. He knew exactly how you get to feel good. You don't get it because somebody pats you on the back and says, you're such a nice girl. Just go home and just everything's going to be okay. He knew that if I wanted to feel good, I was going to have to do the things that I needed to do to rectify whatever was going on in my life. As he said, get back to university if that's what you need. Find out what it is that you need to know so that you can be a contributing member of that community. And I can tell you that's what I did do. And I've had, you know, promotions. I've had job offers more than I even want. I've refused, whatever. Anyway, when I was sober about a year and 9 months, my husband and I separated and finally divorced because I once asked him, do you still blame me for everything that happened? And he said, well, I guess about 90%. And I don't say that as a put down of him. Not at all. But I say it for me. I realized there came a cutoff point. There are certain things I am not willing to live with. I didn't understand it at the time fully. But I realized that I was unwilling to live with somebody else's sickness and take the blame for it. I could take complete responsibility for myself, and I believed that he had to do the same. He had an option. He didn't have to live with my nonsense if he didn't want to. And if he chose to do that, then he's got to take that responsibility. And so eventually I disengaged myself from that and I left. And I was hardly gone when, wonder of wonders, I found the miracle worker. He was gorgeous. He was intelligent. He was rich. He had a wonderful job. He was made for me. The fact that he couldn't stay sober was a minor detail. I knew how to stay sober. So if I know how to stay sober, by God, you're going to learn. So I'm sober about 2 years at this time. And, you know, I think the members of my group sat there and they wondered when I was going to go out. My sobriety was never in question. I was too busy working on him. Crazier than a hoot owl. He'd call on a Friday night. Like, integrity went out the window. But I did what I had to do at that time. And I'm grateful because it brought me the program of Al-Anon. And I tried for 2.5 years to get him sober. I was crazier from his alcoholism, I assure you, than I had ever been from my own. And that's saying something. To the point where one day I found myself, he had come to my apartment while I was gone, and he had the idea that he could taper off. So as I got there, he said, Millie, go get me some beer. And I knew that if he would just pray, I knew it, if he would just pray, God would go, and he'd be sober. So I said, no. I said, Brian, pray. He said, I don't want to pray. He said, get me some beer. I grabbed him by the ears, pounded his head on the bed, and I said, pray, you son of a bitch. Nothing wrong with me. And then I went to Al-Anon. And I will be forever grateful for that. Because you know what I found out? It's one thing to deal with my own problems. It's a hell of a lot harder to deal with somebody else's. That's where I find what I'm really made of. And so, I'd like to get on with this things I want to say now about the spiritual life. I think you can see that I did not slip into alcoholism from a little casual drinking. You can also see why one gentleman who, when I came to the program and I had been talking about having 40 years of experience at something, said, my dear, he said, you haven't had 40 years of experience. He said, you've had 1 year of experience repeated 40 times. And there's an infinite difference. So, I'm at the end of the nine steps. And I have this job, and I'm crazy. I admit that. Like, the teachers that I was with, I thought I should be the one who had the wisdom, because I was the one who had the program, and I was the crazy one. One of them, who became a very close friend of mine, she was like a sponsor outside A. She pulled me aside one day, and she said, you know, Mildred, you better do something about your emotional instability, she said, because I'm beginning to think you've got a hell of a lot more wrong with you than alcoholism. It seems that they noticed a few aberrations in my behavior. Students used to, I'd hear them. And I want, oh, God, I want it to be cool. I'd hear them go down the corridor saying, watch out, she's in a bad mood today. Oh, I would just die, but I knew I was mad. I'd go to meetings and come home all charged up and then wake up in the morning and the old football would be back. And I didn't know what it was. I'll tell you after a while what it was. Anyway, Mac Cheater, who was one of our trustees from Winnipeg, and he had known me for a while, and he used to come and visit me in Toronto, and he was so loving, and he was so gentle, and he was just everything that I wanted to be. And one day I said, Mac, because I thought if he could just tell me what he reads and what he does, and just he could give me a few tips, I could just replicate myself and be just like him, and just sail off into the sunset in serenity. And I said, what do you do, Mac? He said, I practiced steps 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis. Stupid answer. I said, yes, Mac, but I mean, what do you really do? He said, I practice steps 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis. I asked him a couple more times, and I got the same answer. So he said, Mildred, when you understand what I'm saying, you will understand. And that was the end of the conversation. And I realized what he was saying. About 9 months ago, one day, it just suddenly flashed. You have been doing steps 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis. That is the basis of your spiritual program. You see, I believe that everybody has a spiritual life. I believe that what spiritual means is really the life within. We've all got a life within. We've all got a thinking ability within. Some of us use it for the wrong things, and some of us use it to build positive things. I believe that the healthy spiritual life is basically a life of relationships. And I believe that that was why when I got sober, I began to hurt so intensely, because that is when I really began to understand what alcohol and drugs had done in my life. They shielded me from real relationships, but they allowed me at least to keep a modicum of something going between me, because sometimes without alcohol and drugs, I was paralyzed. And so I believe, if you really read some of the literature on mental illness is a withdrawing into oneself, isn't it? Some of the worst cases, other than my own, that I saw in some of those wards were people who stood there and they were unable to relate to anybody. And isn't that another definition for hell? The inability to reach out and to be reached out to. So I used to think that the place to start this was talking about my relationship to others. I don't believe that anymore, because everything flows from my relationship to God. And so I'd like to talk about that first. I don't know who God is. You may be relieved to know that I realize that. I used to have an idea of this anthropomorphic God who was like my father, who could be manipulated and whom I could control and whom I could wheedle things out of, who sometimes was needlessly angry and who sometimes rewarded when I wasn't quite sure why I should be rewarded. I don't believe that anymore. I don't believe in this traditional hell-heaven concept. It's a lot of things. I'll just toss out some ideas. You know, first of all, I've never seen the wind, but I know a bit about the wind because I see what the wind can do. The other thing I think about is gravity. I know three things about gravity, and I think they also apply to God. One, gravity exists. God exists. Two, gravity always acts in a predictable manner. God always acts in a predictable manner. Three, gravity treats all alike. God treats all alike. I like that idea sometimes. I like what Gandhi said. He said, I used to think that God was love. Now I think that love is God. That may mean absolutely nothing to you. When I read it, a light bulb went on in my head. It seemed that love is it. And you can apply the same to truth. I used to think that God was the truth. Now I think that truth is God, and so on. I like that idea. I like the idea of God as the law. I believe that is really the way the world works, through law. Simple. If I plant corn seeds, I put them in good soil, I water them, the sun shines on them, and if the soil is fertile, I don't worry. I know I'm going to get a crop. I think that's very spiritual. I think looking, if I also do not plant any corn seeds, I'm sure not going to expect a crop. You see, that was me all my life. I broke the laws, or I did not plant corn seeds, or I planted weed seeds, but I expected a corn crop. And when I didn't get one, I was angry. And you know what I said? God is sending this to me. God wants me to suffer some more. Who has created my suffering? I have created my own suffering by my own self-will. That's what I believe. So those are some of the things that really are meaningful to me in this whole idea. I believe that God lives within me. I prefer to call it the Spirit. I believe that I am perfect, and I believe that you are perfect, too, because you have the Spirit living within you, and you can't separate the Spirit. You can't cut it into a whole bunch of pieces. If God is within us, he's got to be there completely. And so I believe that I am a perfect being. Why do I not manifest myself as a perfect being? Because I've had bad programming. You know, I think, was it you, Cliff, said we're all the children of somebody? You know, and somebody else said we're all the victims of victims. My parents certainly didn't have a perfect upbringing, and some of the things that they had, they passed on to me. And I think even as individuals grow in consciousness, so I think the race grows in consciousness. And I think we're getting better ideas about God. I accepted all these authoritarian notions when I was a kid. I don't think that's the way it is. I believe that I've got to learn to access what is within me. An analogy that I can give you, well, when things didn't used to go right in my life, I said, it's something to do, obviously, with God. Now, when things don't go right, I know it's something to do with me. It's something in me that has to be changed, because I believe today that my Father is good, and the only thing he wants for me is good. And if I have not got the good in my life, whatever that good is, it's because I'm not accessing what I've got within. We've got a lot of computers at our school for these handicapped youngsters. Some of them are very sophisticated computers. Two buttons on a machine baffle me. So I'm having some trouble getting into these computers. We have all kinds of computer experts in the school that do all kinds of wonderful things with those. Those computers, as far as I'm concerned, may as well not be there, because I have not got the skills to access. And the same, I think, today with what is within me. I've got to get the skills to access the power and the beauty and the love and the life and the light, because it's all there. It's not outside me. And how do I do that? I think a wonderful means is through spiritual reading. Whatever spiritual reading turns you on, I don't think it has necessarily to have the word G-O-D on it. I think novels are good spiritual reading. I think looking at a sunset, 15 martini one, is great spiritual reading. Sure shows you a lot about God, doesn't it? I think looking at the birds flying through the sky can be... Whenever I get in an airplane, to me that's a real spiritual experience, because every time I do, I think, isn't this wonderful that man has progressed to learn the laws, and so that we can have airplanes today, and we have this wonderful aviation. And if I learn the spiritual laws, I can improve my life just as we have improved our physical life through the use of aviation. And I think I learned to access it through meditation. And I believe what the Bible says, be still and know that I am God. I think there are all kinds of meditation, but the kind that I think I'm getting to like best is stillness. And I use that word advisedly, because the eyes want to see and the ears want to hear and the senses want to feel and smell and touch. And when you get all that quiet, then we've got all this root brain chatter that wants to continue and continue. And coming to a point of stillness so that I know who is within, I know who I am, I really find that is my strength. So who am I? I used to compare myself to others, and that doesn't work very well, because either I come off worse or I come off better. Neither one is the truth. We're all made out of the same stuff. And when I look into your eyes, in a way I'm looking at myself, because I believe that we are all indeed the manifestations of God on earth. I have a friend, when I say that, she moves about 5 feet away from me, because I think she thinks I'm blaspheming. But I mean, after all, if we came out of the mind of God, and where else did we come from? You know, the great carpenter of Nazareth said, call no man on earth your father, but one who is in heaven. What is the importance of that? And the only prayer that he ever taught us, that he left behind, starts with the two words, our Father. What does a father do? He brings things into the world that are of a similar nature to himself. A male human being doesn't bring cats into the world. And so if God is indeed our Father, we must be like him. And what is he like? He has the power of choice. He has the power to create and so on. And I believe that's what I am. Wouldn't it be awful if... It's, to me, just absolutely nonsensical to even think about it. That's why I think the old words of pride and humility don't answer this issue. Because if I say I am nothing, that is just stupidity. I am something. I am the manifestation of God on earth as I see it. Therefore, I have nothing to be proud about. I think that pride is really a kind of stupidity. Because it's a failure to acknowledge who and what I really am. That is not to say that therefore I can step on your head, because if I say for myself that I am the manifestation of God on earth, then I have to say that about you. Some weeks ago, Cliff and I were in Galveston. Pat was not there, and we had a very good time, didn't we, Cliff? Let him explain that one if he can. And on Sunday morning, before I spoke, I sat there looking out on the Gulf of Mexico. And as the waves were rolling along, I remembered what I had read one time, that every wave is the manifestation of the ocean. And isn't that true? And is any wave, they're all different in size and depth, etc., etc., but they're all part of the ocean. They are all the ocean manifesting as themselves. And that's what I think I am. I don't always act that way because I've had some bad programming. I think many people have used the concept of God to control us. And I don't think that's a controlling concept that others should put on me. It's a thing that I need to know inside and then respond to, and that's quite a different thing. Because I think those controls put on us from the outside, it's like telling an alcoholic, you know, we've got all the wisdom of the universe in this program. Tell an alcoholic who doesn't want to get sober, you should get sober, you should stop drinking. That's a good reason to go out and get blasted, isn't it? That's like telling somebody, you should live this way because God wants you to. You can make complexes that will follow that person for the rest of their lives. And I think that's one reason why we don't manifest more of the glory that we have within. I wasn't meant to be like you, and you may say thank God for that, and I agree. And you weren't meant to be like me. We're not to be copies. We each have our place in this universe. You ever stop to think of this? This world would not be complete without you. This world needs you. It needs me right where I am, just the way I am. I believe that I'm the best person that I can be today, and that's why living in the now is so important, because today I'm building what, you know, for tomorrow, but I've got to live in the present. Now, what about others? Because ultimately, from this whole idea, as I see it, and I should say this, if you don't like what I'm saying, go to sleep. Or go have a coffee. Don't let me upset you. You didn't ask me to come here and tell you somebody else's ideas. And I will not do you the indignity of regurgitating somebody's ideas. This is how my life has developed. This is how I see the world today. And, you know, if you don't see it that way, I'm not trying to tell you you should. All I'm doing is sharing. If you can pick something up, and if something in you hooks into what I'm saying, that's fantastic. If you think I'm full of it, that's fine, too. It works for me. I'm not the best person, perhaps, or the person I should be. I don't know. But I tell you, I'm a hell of a lot better than I was 15 years ago. And that says something to me about the process that has gone on. Now, what about others? I had the romantic notion that other people could solve my problems, that other people were the answer. I've said it before and I'll say it again. One of the old marriage ceremonies used to say, these two shall be as one. Which one? You create kind of a mathematical impossibility, don't you? I don't think two people can be. They can be one if they are willing to, not by releasing their individuality, but by melding their individuality. I think each one of us very strongly lives in our own skin 24 hours a day, and that there are times when through maybe physical love, mental agreement, whatever the case is, we blend into each other. But I think those are the moments we call ecstasy, aren't they? When we really share with somebody else, when we have really attained union with somebody else. Doesn't happen very often. I had the idea of other people being responsible for me, for my security, for my happiness, and for my feelings. And I can tell you, if you want to have a mad rage, have expectations of other people. It can happen like that. The more I live, the more I think the best thing I can do is to cut my expectations of others. Because we all have such a unique perception of what is going on. No two people in this room, and I don't care if you're identical twins, you don't see the world in the same way. If you take three people to a river, take a painter, take a mother who's just lost her child who's drowned in that river, and take an engineer who wants to build a dam. When they go to look at that river, they're looking at the same objective reality, but they're going to see it in totally different terms. And I think that's the way life is. And then we wonder why we react differently. And, you know, I wonder why people don't see things the way I see them and so on. Expectations create anger. I had expectations that other people would look after me and all that I have told you about. I was trained to be a nice girl. Heavenly. Nuns weren't supposed to yell and curse and scream. My father was authoritarian. I never got to do that when I was a kid. And I got here, and I thought I was a nice, quiet little person. And here I've got this ball of anger inside me. What had happened was over the years, I had just tromped it down and tromped it down and tromped it down. And you know what comes out of that? Anger and depression and all these negative things. And I used to say, you make me angry. In other words, bad little boy, you stop doing that. I read one time that what comes out of a tube is what was in the tube originally. If you squeeze a tube and out comes toothpaste, you know why it came out. If you squeeze a tube of Preparation H, you're going to get Preparation H. If you squeeze an orange, you get orange juice. We're all going to get squeezed on in life, that's for sure. We all get pressed on. Things happen that we don't like. What comes out when I get pushed on is not the fault of the pushing. It is already what is inside me. And so if I don't want to erupt in anger, I've got to change what's inside me. So, and I don't think it's as simple as saying, well, tomorrow, you know, I'm going to go to school and I'm just going to be so sweet and so nice. I used to do that. And in proportion, as I had decided to be sweet and nice, I would be mean and ugly. Because it's what comes out of here. So, how do you do it? Prayer, spiritual reading, meditation, association, getting new ideas, loosing your expectations. That, to me, is how you do it. To me, anger is the biggie of all these negative emotions and thoughts. What is negative stuff? I think that negative stuff is really breaking the first commandment. The first commandment says, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not have strange gods before me. I put many strange gods before my trust in the Father. I believed that people could help me, that events could help me, that if circumstances would change, I would be okay. That pills could do it for me, that alcohol could do it for me. Those are the strange gods that I had. And whenever I have strange gods that I have put before the Spirit within me, I have negatives. Because then I've got a problem. I've got to worry. Are they going to come through? They don't come through. Then I'm angry. Then I get depressed because I'm angry. I'm full of self-pity, and the list goes on. And I mustn't forget resentment, because that's there too. How do you get rid of negatives? I think if you want to get really rid of your negatives, at least it works for me if I have the courage to do it. How do you turn off the electricity in this building? Well, you can do it in one of two ways. You can run around to all the rooms and switch off all the buttons, and that'll drive you nuts. Because by the time you get to the last button, somebody will turn the first ones on again, and you've got to start all over again. You can also throw the master switch. What is the master switch to negatives? I believe it is blame. Blame of others. The strange gods that I put before the true one. If I will just say, I am responsible for this thing. It is not your problem that this is happening to me. I am responsible. It's just like chopping the whole thing off. Once I say I am responsible, then I know exactly where the problem lies, and then I'm within the context of the serenity prayer. I know what I can do. I know what I can change. And then what I need is the courage to do what I can do about the problem. And then I don't have to be resentful and all that whole bag of negatives. It's taken me 15 years to realize, and you may think this is not great progress, just how negative I am. I'm beginning now to realize. I read somewhere one time, about 5 years ago, I guess, a good idea is to try to do a 7-day mental diet. For 7 days, you're not going to think negatively or feel negatively or whatever, no matter what the cost. So I decided, well, you know, I'm really spiritually healthy and I'm right with it and I'm going to do the 7-day mental diet. But he also said, if you break it, you got to give it up. The first time I tried it, I didn't even make it down to the garage. I tried it a second time and I made it out to the freeway. And, you know, I've changed a lot in the last 5 years. If you stick with this program, you will not sit on a stump and stay the same. Life will not stay the same. The situations will differ, and you will draw into your life those things that you need to build your character and make the changes that you need to make in your life. At least that is the way it has happened to me. About 3 years ago, I went to a dinner party one night. And I had gone there with very low feelings of self-esteem. And I would give this to you as a little hint. If something isn't going right in your life, how are you feeling about yourself? I remember, as I look back now, I went there that night thinking, I'm going here with my gentleman friend and this other couple, and I just could feel the warmth engulfing me already. And I thought, gee, this is going to be just wonderful. And I got dressed, and away we went. You know what? The two men, for some reason or other, the conversation flowed by me. They ignored me. Me! And I sat there wondering, you know, feeling worse by the minute. They were discussing, obviously something had come up that was very important and they didn't feel they needed my just opinion. And as the evening went by, I reverted to my 5-year-old strategy for dealing with that. I crawled right into my shell, and I got very depressed, and I went home, and I nurtured my resentment for about 5 days. That's a lot of resentment. And then I tried to forgive. I was able to forgive my gentleman, but I had built up a few things against this other man, and I want to talk about forgiveness for just a few minutes, and then I'll close. Because I just could not seem to get rid of this resentment toward this man. What would happen would be, I would go home and I would pray and I would meditate. And I would think of the need for forgiveness. I don't doubt that I must forgive. The great teacher told us, judge not if you don't want to be judged. Look at what we say in the Our Father. It is so incredibly simple. Forgive me as I forgive others. And to even more emphasize it, at one time he said, if you come to the altar and you want to give your gift to God, and there you remember that your brother has got something against you, not that you're mad at him, but that he's mad at you, leave your gift, go and try and make peace with your brother, and then come and offer your gift. So, I would think in those terms, and I would say, yes, I fully and freely release you. And I would think, okay, the job is done. The problem with that is, you see, when you nurture a grudge for 5 days, you've put a lot of tapes down there. You've dug the groove quite deep. Something would remind me of that situation. And back the feelings would flow. I don't know about you, but when it's feelings versus intellect with me, feelings always win. So I'd be feeling the old grudge again. And I'd wonder, haven't I forgiven? You know, when I look back now, I think, yes, I did forgive. But what would happen was something would remind me of that event and the feelings would come back. And then I had to do it all over again. And this went on for about 1.5 years. Until one morning, with a clarity that I can only describe as incredible, I realized that I had truly forgiven. Because what had happened was I understood it. I had done what I had to do, and finally understanding came. I had gone into that situation with a false god, hoping that that evening they were going to build up my self-esteem. And when that didn't happen, I didn't realize all this was happening at the time. But what I learned from that was that when I am looking to others to build me up, I set myself up for some terrible goings-on inside. Have you got anybody to release this morning? We're going to be going home very soon. And I should think that for most of us, there is somebody, there is a situation, there is an event maybe that we're afraid of, maybe a health problem, maybe a child, maybe something in the job. Where is your weak point? Or where is the point that something that you need to deal with? Is there somebody that you must forgive? I think it's a good idea before we leave, because I remember when I was new in the program, I used to hate this point of a conference, because I hated leaving the womb. It was so nice here. It was so warm and so loving and wonderful. And I knew that out there I had uglies to face. Whatever ugly you have out there, you know that it hasn't changed since you came here. And if there's going to be anything, maybe you can think, any change, maybe you can think about it this way. Look at the opportunity we have had to drink in love and laughter and explore the truth with each other and look at the light. And maybe rather than going back there unawares and when the thing jumps up reacting in the old way, maybe right now we can take a minute to think of that person or that situation and send the love and the light to that situation and to that person. And remember that that person too is hurting, and that maybe the light and the love and the warmth that we have gotten here, we can shed over that person and help to heal that situation. And maybe it won't be quite so bad. I have a sponsee who gave me a card. And maybe one of these days I will get off my butt and get them pictures made. Because in it, there's an arm like this and just a big hand. And on this, in the palm of this hand is a little child sitting. And at the bottom of it is a quotation from Isaiah saying, "See, I have carved you in the palm of my hand." And sometimes I do nothing else for a meditation but just look at that picture. And I can see myself there in the hand of God being looked after. A God who's not going to do it for me, but who will allow me to choose and who will help me to make the move. God is never late, and he is never wrong in the way. Same power that knows how to grow Douglas firs and the same power that knows how to spin the universe, that same power knows how to look after us. It's up to me to find out what it is that I should be doing to cooperate. And I would like to close with a little story which somebody asked me to close with. I think sometimes people get sick of hearing these things, but it said so much to me. It's like that, "See, I have carved thee in the palm of my hand." This man was walking down a road in Java, so this story goes. And he turned around, and behind him he saw a very beautiful girl. She was so incredibly beautiful, he couldn't believe his eyes. And he told her how much he admired her. And he said, "You know, I have been smitten with you. Please be mine." And she said, "If you will look behind me, you will see my younger sister, who is even more beautiful than I am." And he looked, and there he saw, coming along the road, the most ugly, misshapen creature that he had ever seen. And in a fit of anger, he said to this first girl, "You deceived me." And she said, "And you deceived me. If you really thought that I was the most beautiful girl in the world, why did you look around?" And I think perhaps in closing, I like the story of Hillary, who was trying to climb Mount Everest. He had made an attempt, seemingly, and it had not been successful. And before he came back to North America,
he went back and he stood in front of the mountain. And he looked at it and he said, "You can't get any bigger, but I can. God bless you.